Welcome to the Anderson Business Advisors Podcast, the nationally recognized preferred provider for asset protection and tax planning in the nation. This show is for real estate investors looking to protect their assets, save on taxes, and build their wealth with Clint Coons. Clint is an attorney, author, avid real estate investor, and featured instructor at Anderson's tax and asset protection events held throughout the country. Enjoy the show.
Hey guys, in this video, what I wanted to cover was insurance. And, you know, why talk about it myself when it comes to obtaining insurance for your properties when we could bring on an expert? And I know most of the videos you're used to seeing me where I go through and I talk about various aspects of real estate investing, using entities, how to tax plan for real estate. But in this particular topic, which is of so importance to every one of you out there who is investing in real estate, you really need to get the insurance right. And rather than try to convey this myself, what I wanted to do in this video is bring on an expert, someone that I've been working with for years in structuring real estate investors on the insurance side to protect their investments. And I could think of no one better than Sean Wodell, the CEO of National Real Estate Insurance Group, to bring on. And we're going to go through some questions and answers to answer most of those questions that I know that you have about how do you get all this stuff set up the right way after the entities are in place to make sure if something goes wrong, you're protected. Hey, Sean, thanks for coming on.
Anytime, Clint. Thanks for having me. Good to be here.
Yeah, this is going to be great because I know I get a lot of questions about this. And so before we get started, you know, why don't you give some street cred to your company and what it does and how long you've been in the business?
Sure. So National Real Estate Insurance Group, we're a national independent insurance agency. When I say that, it means we represent hundreds of companies. And it actually started back in 2008 with Tim Norris, who's my partner, and myself. We were in Cincinnati. He was a nationwide agent. I was just breaking into the business. And we found ourselves at some local REIA events, or real estate investor associations, which I'm sure many of your listeners are familiar with. We found a niche, right? We found a need. There wasn't any insurance presence there. Nobody that was actually serving the needs of these real estate investors. So we came up with this idea a couple, you know, beginning then and really rolled it out a year or two later of National Real Estate Insurance Group, which was a group that we specifically worked with residential real estate investors, predominantly in the 1-4 family space. And we built a program to accommodate for their needs because the insurance industry was not there for them. Like they wouldn't write the policies. They didn't want to service them. They're higher risk. Nobody liked doing them. So we kind of fell into this niche by accident. And here we are 12 or 13 years later as the largest and longest running insurance program in the country for the residential real estate investor. So the uniqueness of our program is the ability to accommodate for locations through all phases of occupancy. So vacant, occupied, renovation, a combination of the three, really whatever your investors have in their portfolios, we put into one single schedule so we can leverage their size and their activity to keep their property rates stable over time. And that's a monthly reporting form. So it's pay as you go. So no minimum earned premiums, no long-term commitments to the coverage, which anybody that's doing renovations or flips will be very familiar with of not wanting to have that, right? They're higher risk, those properties by the insurance agency or the insurance industry, and they want a long-term commitment. They want an investor to pay for 6 or 12 months at a time. And then if that flip gets done early, they go to cancel that coverage, they can't get any money back. So we saw a lot of challenges in the industry back in 08, and some of them hold true today, and there's some new ones as well. And all we wanted to do was build a program to alleviate those. And I think we've done a pretty good job. We're all 50 states. So wherever you're investing that we can accommodate for, and we've started to branch out really over the last few years and be able to accommodate not only for traditional rentals or fix and flips, but vacation rentals. We've got self-storage programs. We can do non-performing notes, lender place. So if you're lending on stuff and you have to force place. So really it's become a one-stop type of shop for all of our investor clients. They are never going to need or want to have to go anywhere else to acquire any insurance product they need or are required to have by one of their lenders.
Wow. I know you, I mean, you just covered a lot there. And, you know, for the people that are watching or listening to this, what I want them to understand is that the reason why you're here is because so many people don't get this information when it comes to setting up the insurance because they keep running into roadblocks with people. And we'll get into that. But I want to know, you know, just for somebody that's listening and watching this, what type of policies, if you're going to be a landlord and you're going to buy property and you're going to hold it long term, what type of coverage do you need?
Well, first things first, and this will be kind of what we touch on later, is whatever owning entity or entity that purchased the asset in question has got to be listed as the first name to trade on the insurance policy. Regardless of what anyone tells you, that's got to be the case, right? But at the very minimum, you need property and liability coverage. Now, every investor situation is different, which is kind of what sets us apart from all of our competitors or ones that try to play in our space is we kind of go through a full analysis with an investor client to make sure that we figure out what their pain points are, what their exit strategy is, what their investment strategies are, so we can develop the coverage that's appropriate for them. On the property side, you know, obviously you want to cover the dwelling, you want to look at loss of rents coverage. You want to look at if you've got detached structures like garages or something you'd want to extend coverage to if it were to blow away or burn to the ground. And then if you're in vacation rentals or you're furnishing your locations, you want some contents coverage or business personal property. Then from there, you can kind of fluff up the form. You can look at equipment breakdown. You can look at earthquake and flood. You can look at ordinance or law and some of these add-on coverages you have available. Property coverage is really just kind of is what it is. Every investor is different. Some choose just to self-insure those properties, right? If I pick up a property for $10,000, I know that it's vacant. If it burns to the ground, I'm out 10 grand. I can maybe stomach that and don't necessarily need the property coverage. Again, every investor is different. Liability is a whole different animal. So liability is one that you should never go without. Even if you're wholesaling a property and you have ownership interest in the property for a day, purchase the liability coverage through us. It's a monthly reporter. So you pay $7 or $8 a month and have that peace of mind that if God forbid somebody were to slip and fall, get injured or worse on that property, and you're named in the lawsuit, that liability coverage would kick up and provide that coverage for you so you're not stuck out on an island with no coverage and having to pay that out of pocket. So at the very least, property and liability, and then there's obviously some extensions on there as well with different lines of coverage that we offer if it's necessary or needed for that investor.
All right. So you got to have that coverage, and knowing, you know, what's covered versus what isn't, I think is a challenge for people. And I'll give you a couple examples here. Scenario number one, I'm a real estate investor. I'm in the process of rehabbing the property because the tenants trashed it. And we're on day 45 of the rehab because I can't get materials right now, or contractors are slow because they're so busy to get to my project. Somebody comes out and they're hurt on the property. Now, it's a rental property. It had this typical policy, landlord policy in place, but it's been vacant for 45 days. Am I covered?
With NREG, with National Real Estate Insurance Group, absolutely. Unfortunately, not every carrier is the same way. You have to dig into those policies that you purchase and figure out where their vacancy provisions start and end. Some of them say at day 31, if that location's still vacant, when the initial policy was set up as occupied, coverage ceases. So you've got to be careful. So I always say the way to read an insurance policy is look at the declarations pages first. Look at, you know, the contact information, the address of the location, the insured values that you've decided upon to purchase. And then flip all the way to the back and look at the endorsements and exclusions, because those are the ones that can really harm you. And vacancy provision is where that's going to be held, is right there at the end. So you got to be careful on that. With NREG, that's not a problem, because we're able to accommodate through all phases of occupancy. So no, coverage would never be diminished. One side note to that one is, you mentioned, hey, this is a renovation property and there's probably GCs and workers on site. So it would really have to depend on what the cause of that liability loss was. Was it just somebody that was injured on site, or was it something that had to do with the general contractor being negligent? Did they leave their ladder in the front yard? That person tripped and fell in the front yard and got injured. So in that situation where the general contractor would be at fault, we always say, we tell our investor clients, look, if you've got a GC that's going to be working on site, you need to make sure that you require a couple of pieces of information from them. You want their proof of liability coverage, as well as their workers' comp coverage if they have employees with them. But in addition to that, your owning entity needs to be listed as additional insured on their general contractor's liability policy for the duration of time they're working at your property. And we do that so that their liability coverage extends to you.
Exactly. And we're going to come back to that, because that's a real important point about using entities. Yep. And how we insure those and how they get named under the policy. Yep. I got two more quick ones for you. Okay. And one of them has to do with the aspect of animals. So here's a scenario. Yep. My assistant's boyfriend, he came down with COVID and he lost his sense of smell. This is a great story. So he can't smell, can't taste anything. She's no longer living there at the house. He's living by himself. And they have this big black lab. And the black lab came into the house one day and he's just kind of acting weird, and he starts foaming at the mouth after about a couple hours of being in the house. And he thinks to himself, man, something's going wrong with my dog. So he contacts the vet and he throws a dog in the truck, goes down to the vet, and the vet takes a little while to come out to see him. And the vet opens up the door and he says, what's wrong? He says, my dog. He goes, oh my gosh, your dog has been sprayed by a skunk. And he's like, what? He goes, yeah, your dog, can't you smell? He's like, no, I've got COVID. I can't smell anything right now. Yeah. So here's what happens. He gets his sense of smell back. The house is trashed. The carpets, the hardwood floors in the house, 50 to 60% of their clothing items and things smells of skunk. His truck smells of skunk, and they don't know how to get it out. Call the insurance provider. Mm-hmm. Not covered. How does somebody, I mean, I know that's an extreme scenario there, but if I'm a landlord now and I have that property and the tenants, they vacate it, how do I protect against that type of outlier event?
Yeah. So the easiest way to do that is to require them, your tenant, to carry renter's insurance and make sure that renter's insurance has some kind of provision in there to cover damage by pets. Now, that's a unique scenario. So depending on how each policy is written, that could still be an exclusion, but tenant damage is always excluded off of investor's property policy. But that's something that it's really considered uninsurable by the insurance carrier. So what they look at is they say, okay, you've got a couple things. You've got security deposits that should help you through that. And then if you have a situation where, you know, your tenant goes sideways and they start to give you trouble and you're afraid they're going to bash the walls up on the way out, there's cash for keys programs and alternatives to insurance care coverage. Probably what I would recommend there is not only to put it into your lease that they have to cover, they have to carry renter's insurance, but you got to enforce it and make sure that you're listed, that the investor is listed as additional interest, not additional insured, but additional interest on those renter's policies, so that they're going to be notified prior to that coverage canceling for non-payment or any other underwriting issue. And then you can also say that, hey, part of your renter's product or policy that you have to purchase has to have coverage for animal damage, right? And then so you can structure those policies a little bit. And there's carriers out there that provide that. We're working on one right now called Canine Guard that we should be rolling out probably end of Q1 for 2021 that should have some coverage in there for something like that. But yeah, that's a really unique scenario, man. But that's probably the best way to do it is to fall back on the renter's policy.
Got it. So you have to have name yourself as the owner. The owner of the property needs to be named as an additional interest is what you're saying.
Correct. Yeah. They won't be additional insured because the main advantage to the renter in that case is the contents coverage, right? Tornado blows away the property. You as the investor are made whole again. Your tenant's belongings are all at a loss unless they have that coverage. So you're not an additional insured because you don't have any ownership interest in their contents, but you can be additional interest and be notified prior to that coverage canceling.
Okay. How about toxic mold?
So most property policies do exclude that completely. That's one of the things that took the insurance industry by storm back in the 80s and 90s, and it's been an ongoing event. What NREG did and what we've done and what I built into our policies is at least a supplement for that. So I can't, you know, if you're insuring the dwelling to $100,000, I can't provide $100,000 of mold coverage, but I can provide $15,000, which is a supplement assigned to it to help. And we'll meet or exceed lending guidelines every time. So if there's a lender that says you've got to have limited mold coverage, that supplement will provide enough coverage for this to satisfy them.
Okay. So when I build out my portfolio, now I have 8 properties. Do I still need to go and acquire a separate policy for each property? Or can I get an umbrella that would cover everything?
Yeah, so umbrella is kind of a dirty word in the insurance. Let's take that back. It's an overused word in the insurance industry. You don't necessarily need 8 policies for 8 locations, and doing that really puts you at the mercy of the underwriter and what they want to assign as a property rate and liability rate for each risk. So what we did is we built this to where we're able to accommodate and put every location for an investor on a single schedule. So as their portfolio grows, we just add locations to that schedule. When it comes time to renew that piece of business, if there's 8 locations that grew from 4 or goes to 12, that gives us more leverage to negotiate those rates down with the underwriter. So people will use blanket form. It's not a blanket form. It's individual limits per location, but we're leveraging that investor's activity. So if they do successful flips throughout that annual term, that's looked at just as favorably as adding locations to that portfolio. And then, you know, so you put it on a single schedule, one or two insurance companies, whether it's property and GL, and we just leverage that to keep them going month over month and keep the rate stable. So no, I wouldn't do an individual policy per location. There's better alternatives.
Okay. So you do one policy basically that covers, that lists out all of these additional properties that are covered under that policy. You just, of course, would structure it to fit the investment itself based upon the nature of the asset. But what about obtaining an umbrella policy on top of that? Recommend it? Is it worth it?
Yeah, I'm never going to say no on an umbrella. Umbrellas are, first, umbrellas don't do anything to help you on the property coverage. So it doesn't extend to dwelling coverage, loss of rents, anything like that. What it does is it's a cost-effective way for you to garner additional liability coverage above and beyond whatever your primary premises liability will provide. So in our program, each and every location that's insured with us gets $1 million per occurrence, with a $2 million annual aggregate limit. So think about that as the max. $2 million is the maximum amount of coverage that would be paid out under a liability policy for slip and falls, personal injuries, wrongful deaths, over a 12-month period that resets to a new limit at renewal every year. Okay. Now, many investors look at that and go, wow, $1 million per occurrence and $2 million aggregate, and it's per location limits. That's more than I'm ever going to need, right? But there's other investors that say, wow, that doesn't seem to be enough. So an umbrella would be able, is a way that they can acquire additional liability coverage, and they can purchase that in the form of an excess liability or umbrella policy. We can go up to $200 million if they need to. On average, when you start to get around 8 to 10 locations in your portfolio is when investors historically tend to start looking at umbrellas as additional asset protection.
Yeah. So what it sounds like is that you've already got the umbrella policy really built in. And so they would want an excess liability. But my understanding is that the difference between the two is that with an umbrella policy, you're dependent on the underlying policy to cover you. So let me throw this at you. Mm-hmm. You've got the scenario where it's a environmental contamination, toxic mold. You cover $15,000 of that. Judgment's entered against me for $1 million. Because the family is exhibiting all these signs, or maybe it was even COVID. Now, you give me 15 grand, but I have $1 million umbrella policy. I'm not covered under that umbrella, correct? Because the underlying policy capped at 15. Is that fair to say?
The $15,000 in mold coverage that I was speaking to had to do with property damage. So that would be a property coverage. Oh. If you have mold coverage on your liability, which most don't, There are pollution, quote unquote, riders that you can add to that policy. Ours does that, but it does it to like carbon monoxide. And if a tenant were to pass away or get sick from carbon monoxide, they would have up to the policy limits. In your example, let's just say that there was a mold rider onto that liability policy. If there was $50,000 of mold coverage, then the umbrella could step in and pick up another $50,000. They're not going to exceed whatever the underlying limit is, but it's not necessarily going to be a declination either. Most umbrellas actually follow the form of the primary or underlying liability. So if it's included on the primary, it's included on the umbrella, and the same goes with exclusions.
How about the excess liability policy? Is that different?
It is. Umbrellas have the ability to go over multiple lines of coverage. So whether you have investment properties, maybe you have professional liability, maybe you have commercial auto, and you need that umbrella to encompass several lines of coverage to provide additional liability, that's what those will do. Excess liability are usually a little bit more cost effective, but they're limited to going over one line of coverage. So I could put an excess liability policy in place for you, same $200 million if you needed to, but would only extend to your investment properties. So there's two different options. Umbrellas go over multiple lines, excess for one.
All right. So the question that comes up a lot when you're structuring your policy and you're using entities, people always want to know, you know, I'm asked, well, who should be the insured? Who's the additional insured, or what is a named additional insured or additional named insured? It's kind of confusing, especially on the additional insured portion, what the differences mean.
Yeah. So again, on the named insured, the first named insured is always going to need to be the entity that purchased the property, right? If you purchase it in LLC, the LLC needs to be listed as the named insured. Each officer of the LLC has coverage underneath the LLC. So the individual names don't have to be listed in addition to. Additional insured is usually reserved for liability coverage. And then mortgagee or lost payee is on the property side. So mortgagee and lost payee is typically your lender that lended funds to acquire the property and is named on a claim check in conjunction with the first named insured, right? So collectively, after the property burns, they're both named and they decide how the money is divvied up to make the repairs. On the liability side, on the additional insured, what that does is provides additional liability for anybody that's named. So if you and I go into a property together, maybe it's my LLC, you lended some money on it, you would be listed as additional insured. So God forbid a slip and fall were to happen and we are both named in that lawsuit, the liability coverage that I've purchased extends to you, okay? Because you're listed as additional insured.
But what's the additional named insured though? How does that differ? Because I've seen that term thrown about.
It's not, it's the same thing.
All right. Same thing. Just how they want to do it.
Yeah, and it's basically the advantage to the additional insured is just like the additional interest on the renter's policy, right? So if I'm the first named insured and I'm not paying my bills and my insurance coverage is in jeopardy of lapsing, you're notified prior to that happening. So you can get in touch with me and say, hey, Sean, pay the insurance, right? And get it taken care of.
Okay. So to recap what I've heard then is that if you're a landlord, if you're buying investment property, you want to have dwelling coverage, you need liability coverage, your tenants should have a tenant coverage as well with you named as additional interest, I think is what you said, under their policy. And then you might want to consider putting in place an umbrella policy on top of that if you have more than 8 units. Is that fairly sum it up?
It does. Yeah. More than 8 units. Or if you've had a bad experience in the past where you got hit for $1 million on a slip and fall or an injury at the property, and you think a million's not enough. There's no right or wrong answer to when the umbrella should start. It's up to the individual investor and what helps them sleep at night. So I've actually got investors that have thousands of locations with us that go with a single $1 million, $2 million limit with no umbrella. And then I've got other investment groups that purchase them 5 at a time, and they buy a $10 million umbrella in addition to the primary liability for each owning entity and for each asset. So it's really up to the investor.
So why is it, you know, the State Farms and the Allstates out there, when you call them up, why did they get this all screwed up? I mean, you talk to them and all they tell you is you can't do that, you can't do this, can't do that. All we can do is write one little policy for you. What's going on out there?
It just depends on what they have. I may do the same thing if they call me and say, hey, I need you to do my homeowner's coverage, right? It's really what they specialize in. So they are phenomenal companies. I mean, I use them as well for my homeowners and my auto, but you've got to get with the right type of company and programs that have appetites for these risks. Non-owner occupied, dwellings or renovation locations, and certainly vacant locations, are considered higher risk by the insurance industry. And those household names don't necessarily have the appetite to write those higher risk locations. They'll do it from time to time, just kind of as a, they kind of feel obligated to do so for their existing client base. But many of them have like a limit. If you go above 3 or 4 locations, we can't do it anymore. There's limitations to the liability coverage that aren't favorable to an investor. So it's just about finding the right niche products for what you're doing. I mean, there's State Farm, those guys are great, but not when it comes to investment properties. You need to work with some specialists that do nothing but this. And that's why the 12 or 15 companies that power our program all do that. They all have an appetite for this. These policies are built specifically for revenue generating assets, or at least what it's supposed to be once they become occupied. So it's just about what the carriers have appetites for.
Got it. All right. I'm going to switch over now. I'm going to bring up my screen because I want to go through a scenario with you.
Sure.
That has to do with, you know, how a lot of people end up structuring their real estate. For a lot of individual investors, they're either going to structure it as follows. Well, I talk about a lot on my channel setting up a land trust right here. So here's a land trust. And that land trust in turn would be held by a limited liability company, which we're going to make the beneficiary. And in some cases, this is even held by a secondary LLC that's in Wyoming. And just to throw another wrinkle into this, okay, to make it complicated for you, is that this property wasn't purchased in the land trust or in that red box LLC. I bought the property in my own name because I got financing on it. So, because, you know, I put down 10% down on one of those Fannie programs they have out there. And I got into this first investment deal. Now I want to protect it. So I then transferred it into the land trust. I get this set up. And now I want to get my insurance into place.
Here we go. So once you transfer that property into the land trust, mm-hmm. That land trust, the beneficiary, and the additional LLC should be listed as the first named insured on your insurance policy.
Okay, so don't go too fast now. So you're saying that this is a named insured?
It is, yep.
And you can have more than one named insured?
You can.
Okay, so this is a named insured?
Yes, it would all be connected one right after the other.
Okay, who else would be a named insured on this?
I put the Wyoming LLC on there as well.
Just in case.
Just in case, yep. Now, if your lender kicks back, because what's going to happen is your lender is going to push back, right? They're going to say the loan is in your personal name, Clint. Why is the insurance in the land trust name? So it's not necessary on the insurance side. However, to satisfy your lender on the type of loan that you took out, we would list Clint Coons also as a named insured. That will, in most instances, satisfy your lender enough to move forward and accept the insurance that's in place.
Okay. So would we then use the word additional insured on this policy anywhere in this scenario here?
The only place I would say put additional insured, or who would be listed as additional insured, would be your lender.
Lender. Okay. Because there was a scenario I was recently working through with a client. I think he was using Allstate on this deal. And they knew that the property was in a land trust. We put it into a land trust. But they'd only have one named insured, they said. They wouldn't name him as a named insured. They put the land trust down. And so then we had to name the trust as the additional insured on the policy, and same with the LLC. I wasn't aware why they wanted that set up that way.
its limitations and probably understanding on what they're, you know, how they handle land trusts. I'm actually surprised they would even offer coverage. What I'm speaking to is how NREG does it, which is the correct way to do it. And all of our carriers actually agree with that. So all those in our case will be listed as named insured. They may not all fit on the evidence of insurance right there on the named insured box. That's mm-hmm. why there's a comment section to list all the named insureds that go with it. So yeah, those will all be first named insured with the lender listed as additional.
All right. So let's assume then we put together this scenario where I have built out my real estate portfolio to four trusts or LLCs, whatever it is. Now we write one policy that covers all of these, correct?
Correct.
And then that one policy would name all of these as the named insured?
That's correct.
So you just keep typing that stuff onto the policy is what you're doing.
Yeah. So individual evidence and certificates of insurance that outline the property and liability coverage, it's assigned to that location in question, but there's common ownership among all four of those, right?
Absolutely. So what you have typically is a scenario like this, all owned by this, all owned by me.
Correct.
All common ownership. Do you need to see the docs when you're doing this, or what do you need from the client in order to put something like this together for the policy?
No closing docs, anything like that. Just really, we work directly with investors that just give us the LLC and the name of the properties that are assigned or the locations that are assigned to that LLC, and we structure it for them. So no, the carriers don't ask for that. They're typically okay with just what the carrier or what the insured provides us.
Okay. So if I told you had a land trust, you don't need to see a copy of the trust. You'll just take down whatever information I provide.
Correct.
A lot of structures when we're setting them up, anonymity is important. We don't want our information out there in the public record. So on title, when we structure these things with a land trust, if we're using that entity, it'll be a land trust here, and the client may have, we'll use an LLC, say this is something advisory services, say it's real estate advisory services as the trustee of their land trust. Does that impact it? Do you guys even care about that? You're just putting it in the name of the trust, so it's no big deal.
It's in the name of the trust, but you can list the trustee and the named insured in addition to that actual trust name so that they're both listed on there. So no, that's not any problem at all.
And then you mentioned for people who are involved in flipping real estate, that if I'm out there flipping and here's a typical scenario, I'll have a corp set up here for tax purposes on the flips, and then I'll structure each flip through its own separate limited liability company like this.
Great idea.
What do we do?
You can list the corp as well as the LLC.
So these are named.
Those are both named.
Yep. Yep.
And if you had a second location underneath a different LLC, because there's common ownership in the corp, you could do it on one account.
One account. Well, how about if I'm just turning the properties, would I just keep one account open and just tell you, hey, I got another property, or you have to close it down every time and reissue a new one?
Keep it open. We have a lot of investors that do that. They'll do one or two flips at a time and they'll keep their account open. And maybe 2 months out of the year, there's nothing on their portfolio at all. We just don't bill them any amount of money because there's no coverage. And then when they come in, they acquire the next one, they just add it back to their portfolio.
Wow. That's so simple to do it that way. And it speeds up the process most assuredly when you're providing that protection.
Yeah. And even better is we developed a client portal, which it's been a few years now, and we continually enhance it. So some investors would prefer to call and talk to a live CSR, a licensed rep, hey, add this property and we'll do that for you. And there's other ones like I would do that. I'd log on and do it myself. So you can go on and self-serve and add and delete as you need to.
Well, that's awesome. I mean, I use Geico for my vehicles. And yeah, whenever you swap out a vehicle, you just go on the app, fill it out, and boom, you're covered just like that.
Yep, absolutely. And you can pull proof of coverage right away. So you've got documents. So if you get to the closing table and you're like, I've got everything in line, but I forgot my insurance, you can get proof of coverage from us in 5 or 10 minutes. So we're not holding up closing.
That's great. Airbnb. So in that scenario, it's going to be similar. A lot of times we'll have it structured where I put in the properties in this LLC and I'll run a corporation up here for the business aspect of their Airbnb investing. Okay. And we enter into what's called a master lease, where the LLC leases the property to the client's corporation, and then the client's corporation deals with the Airbnb tenants that rent out the space. So we're collecting maybe $10,000 here on a monthly basis. We're paying $6,000 back to the LLC that the client owns. How does that get structured then?
So you want both the LLC and the corp listed as named insureds. And the reason you want that is because it's really property-wise, it kind of is what it is. They both need to be listed on there. property is going to, you know, God forbid you were to suffer a loss, your LLC and your corporate are going to be listed on that claims check. I'm more concerned with the liability exposure there, because if someone were to get injured on site, you can bet your money that whatever attorney is retained to do that is going to look up any kind of ownership interest they can find on an auditor's side or anything else, and they're going to name anyone that's got ownership interest. So we don't want to leave your LLC exposed. We don't want to leave the corporation exposed. So we would list them both.
And now, is there any certain special type of policy you need with an Airbnb that's outside of what we've already discussed?
You know, not really. The Airbnb industry, just like Uber, took the insurance industry by storm, right? It was like, wow, how do we respond to this? And for the longest time, trying to obtain insurance coverage for an Airbnb was difficult. And that's because the liability exposure was written so differently. It was written like a hotel motel, which if you're doing resorts and hotel and motels, you know that the insurance coverage is not cheap on the liability side, right? Since then, because now we've got the insurance industry's got some history there, and they can figure out what that loss ratio is and what they can project out. Now, not so much. So like our program in the last 24 months now has the ability to accommodate for Airbnbs, which means the liability coverage as well as the property. The only really challenge with property coverage was the security measures, making sure that the codes were changed in between each tenant. There was cameras. There was, you know, whatever you could do to secure the property, and also the contents coverage, because most property policies that are for investors don't have business personal property or contents coverage as an option, because you're not furnishing those homes. So what do you have in there that you would need to cover it for? Now these policies actually will allow you to include contents coverage. So if you've got $100,000 of furniture in there, you can provide coverage for it on our form.
Yeah. So if they steal it or break it because they had a big party.
Yep.
All right. So, you know, this is timely. What about COVID? Have you had any claims that have been brought because of that? How about, you know, people haven't been able to be paid on their rents because of COVID. What is the industry response to that, and where do you see it going?
Yeah, so COVID's going to be a multi-billion dollar claim. It's going to drag out over a number of years. The thing I can relate to the most is when asbestos or mold hit the market. Mm-hmm. You knew that right then you weren't going to get all those claims, and this was going to continue to trickle in year over year. And you're seeing the insurance companies begin to respond to that. Most of the property policies that investors have options to purchase, including ours, have full bacteria and virus exclusions. And for a loss of rents type of claim to be triggered, direct physical loss has to happen at the property, which virus and bacteria don't do, right? The property has to be left uninhabitable from a fire or wind or something else that left it uninhabitable. So in our space, it was largely a non-issue from a claims perspective. Now, doesn't take away from the challenges that all of our investors face and are still facing. And mm-hmm. we can talk about TPP and how that's a little bit different here in just a second. But the insurance industry as a whole is reeling from that, because if those policies weren't written with those specific exclusions, claims are being paid. So the restaurant industry and the hotel industry and some of those larger type of policies that carriers are playing in, they're paying some claims on that. In terms of not being able to collect on rents and, you know, then evictions coming down the line once the moratorium's lifted, we have a product called Tenant Protector Plan. And one of those sublimits that's included on that coverage is skip rent. Skip rent provides a one-time payment of $1,000 to one of our investor clients if one of their tenant passes away mid-lease, if they're deployed to the military, if they just pack up and leave in the middle of their lease and don't tell anyone, or if an eviction has to happen. So what it's designed to do is try to minimize what the financial hardship is for our investor while they're scrambling to find another tenant. So skip rent will pay on COVID if you had it, if you had already purchased it or did purchase it, and then you've had something happen since then. It's limited to a one-time payout of $1,000, or if your rent's $750, you'd be paid $750 the first month, $250 month two if you haven't found a new tenant. So skip rents, but it's unique to us. I don't know that there's anybody else in the industry that has mm-hmm. that included. It's just something that, you know, it sounded like a great idea before COVID because I wanted to have that. And it's turned out to be a good idea for our investor clients because it's helped many of them. It will help more. Yeah.
You guys probably, I would doubt if you covered this, but have you seen this come up? Housing discrimination claims, wrongful terminations, and they're suing. I was talking about it here in Washington State. The way it's structured now, if you're a landlord and you agree to show the property to five individuals, you have to choose the first person that you bring out there as the first tenant choice. And so you have to work through it in order. So if you brought out five people and the first person you find out is unemployed, arrived there on a skateboard, they have no means of paying, you still got to offer it to them. You can't skip to number three, the person that you want to rent it to, under law. So they could sue you if you did that. How do the policies handle that now? Or is it just something you're not going to handle because the risk is too high?
you know, that was one that, again, the insurance industry was kind of like, wow, what do we do? And they're starting to respond. So I have built a couple of master policies that we're rolling out probably in the next couple of months. They're almost finished for wrongful eviction, tenant discrimination. So to try to help with those coverages, it's usually, it'll probably be a $250,000 sub limit, but still, you know, that's, it's a lot better than not having any coverage at all. It's not, and it can be an extension to the liability policy. You're also seeing, you know, kind of the piggyback on that is, you know, states that are requiring you to come up with the security deposit alternative. So instead of having to take cash, you know, so we've got that now too, ready to roll out as well. So where we don't necessarily, we understand the challenges. It's probably not the way we'd go about it, but you know, we want to be able to, we're going to be able to offer every product we can to our investor clients to help them along the way. So those are two of those offerings that we've responded to and we started to build products for that are coming out in the very near future.
Anything else that you think that might be important to people that are watching this right now?
The biggest thing for us, I mean, that we find is we love getting in with investors when they start off. And as obviously as they succeed, we succeed with them. So challenge your insurance agents, ask questions. They're the experts on this matter. And don't be afraid to say, hey, Clint, hey, Sean, whatever, I've got some concern here and I want to make sure that I have this covered, right? Do your homework on a property before you invest in it and decide to acquire it. There's all kinds of information out there readily available for you to do that. One of the tools that we use when you were to send a property to me and say, Sean, I'm going to purchase 123 Main Street, we pull a whole list of data about that property in the surrounding area. So you can take a look at that and find out what quality of that property is, what you can expect to see from controllable losses, what you can expect to receive from rental income, you know, what your flood exposure is, your earthquake exposure. So do your homework and partner with some experts that can actually give you that data to make sure that you know that it's a property you want to invest in. Maybe there's flood issues. Maybe there's losses in the past you weren't made aware of that can harm your ability to obtain cost-effective insurance. Just do your homework and make sure that you work with somebody that can help you along the way before you decide to acquire that property.
That's great. Now, in the show notes, I got a link for people that can reach out to you and, well, not you particularly, but to National Real Estate Insurance Group and get some information. So how would that process work? Do they just click on the link and then go and fill out the information?
It's a couple of minutes of a questionnaire. It's going to ask some basic information about the property, which is going to trigger one of our sales advisors, one of our licensed sales advisors, to contact you to make sure that we can walk through that scenario we ran through earlier, right? So what the exit strategy is, what your investment strategy is, what your appetite for risk is. Some people are like, yeah, it's investing in a good area. I don't think I need theft coverage. Maybe I'm investing in the Southeast. I know that I'm not going to have water damage coverage because I'm not going to have pipes that freeze and burst. So I can look at basic form as an alternative. So we really kind of get on the phone, structure that coverage package unique to each investor. So a couple minutes on the questionnaire, probably a 15 to 20 minute phone call. And then going through the proposal process is just, hey, here's your options. Here's A, B, C, and D. These are the differences and allow that investor to choose what's best for them.
Yeah. And it's like you said, you know, a lot of people that I know invest remotely. And so they're buying properties in different states and they're not aware of the issue. Say it's Texas with hail or things like that. And so by dealing with someone who is familiar with the area that you're investing in, that works with renters or landlords, I think you're going to be better off because you're going to be able to give us or tell me as the investor, hey, these are some things you ought to consider because I've seen these scenarios before and you want to protect against them. So yeah, for a plug for you guys.
I appreciate that. And we're giving them answers to the test before they take the test, hopefully. So
yeah, there you go. Sean, thanks. It's been great. You gave us a ton of information. It's going to help out everybody on here. It went way longer than I thought, but it was so interesting to the topic. So with that, take care.
You too. Good to see you. Take care of yourself.
And you.
Thank you for listening to today's podcast. Show notes for links to everything mentioned in this episode can be found on our website at andersonadvisors.com/podcast. Be sure you subscribe to our podcast. And if you are already a subscriber, please provide us a review of what you thought of this episode.